thanks everyone for joining us.
This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, so my name is Daniel Apoy. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Arizona with a joint appointment in Stewart Observatory and the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory, so the Department of Astronomy and Planetary Sciences. My research focus lies on planet formation and exoplanet characterization. I'm leading several larger efforts, which include a Spitzer exploration science program with over 1,000 hours on Spitzer and a coordinated Hubble program. I'm also a PI of a new initiative called Earth in Other Solar Systems. This is part of the new Nexus for Exoplanet System Science program. I'm also leading a large program on Hubble, large legacy program, and I'm also serving on the ExoPEG Executive Committee this year. So my focus is, the talk's focus will be on observational characterization of ultra-cool atmospheres, what we can do today with existing facilities, and what we can do in the future. Okay, so Harley, do you want me to start with the talk?
Yep. Okay. Please go on. The floor is yours. And again, remember, since you have most folks are invisible to you, please note from time to time what page you're on.
Okay. So this talk, I will show you a new series of projects we have been carrying out that use a technique that's, I think, very relevant, not only for current observations, but for the next generation telescopes we are going to build. And I think this is an excellent forum to discuss this idea, and I thank for the invitation. So the talk's title is Extrasolar Storms in High Definition, Cloud Physics and Atmospheric Dynamics in Exoplanets. So I'm going to show you in the talk, in the first half, the larger part of the talk, I will show you recent results from various space-based facilities. And illustrate with these results what the state of the art is in this field, and give the motivation with these results for what more, and we can do much more in the future with the next generation facilities. So as this is a remote talk, I will probably stop at the one-third and two-third of the talk just to see if there are any questions that are important for understanding anything that I mentioned, and then I will take most of the questions at the end if that works.
Great. Sounds fine.
Okay. So the second slide, I'm just showing collaborators. As I mentioned, these are results from multiple large programs, and I have an excellent group of collaborators. On the left-hand side, I highlighted the people who work or have worked in my group, but the collaboration itself is, of course, international. So on the third slide, you will see the motivation, the overall motivation. And for the project that we are currently carrying out, we are focusing on relatively hot atmospheres in terms of exoplanets, but very cool compared to stars. So these atmospheres, we call them ultra-cool atmospheres, and these basically include hot Jupiters, directly imaged exoplanets, and brown dwarfs. With next-generation facilities like such as ATLAS or HDSD or a similar concept, we will be able to look in reflected light and probe cooler objects. But for now, we are limited to thermal emission, and that means warmer objects. Nevertheless, these are very much on the frontier of exoplanets and brown dwarf studies. And these are among the coolest and are the coolest atmospheres that we can currently study. What I wanted to point out here is that you have probably heard many talks over the past years on various aspects of understanding different types of exoplanet and brown dwarf atmospheres. What I wanted to point out here and stress is that this distinction, hot Jupiters, directly imaged exoplanets, or brown dwarfs, is in many ways coming in part from our observational technique. If you just imagine Jupiter moving closer to the Sun, it would become a hot Jupiter. If it would move a bit farther and we would be able to image it, it would be a directly imaged exoplanet. And if it were to be ejected from the solar system, we would study it as a brown dwarf. So ultimately, the atmospheres, the underlying physics and chemistry is very similar or identical in many of these objects. It's often, though, just the way we characterize them or the situation in which we can observe them puts them in certain categories. But our goal should be to develop a generalized model, a model that will explain all of these atmospheres. I want to show you how we are progressing toward that goal. So on the next slide, I just wanted to show you a very high-level overview of if we are to explain the spectra of ultracool atmospheres in all three categories that I mentioned before, the key factors that go in are the temperature and the gas phase absorbers that are present at a given temperature, and I would argue that we have a reasonably good understanding of that. We have an understanding of how the spectrum will change if we change the composition or the metallicity of the atmospheres, and we have predictions and an increasing understanding of how the surface gravity will influence the spectra. None of these are fully understood, but I think we made very significant progress, and our models produce overall good results. Where the biggest uncertainty and the biggest challenge lies are clouds and hazes, particles in the atmosphere, and because they play very important roles, it's important that we understand them, but physically they are also probably the most challenging of these various factors. Clouds and hazes are known to exist in all types of exoplanets and brown dwarfs, and essentially in every object in the solar system with significant atmosphere. Okay, so in the next slide, I show you a brief overview of what our models predict, what type of clouds we should think about when we are considering objects in the temperature range between, say, 700 and about 2,000 Kelvin. So on the top, so in this figure, you should see various clouds with T-dwarf, L-dwarf, and ML transition labels on the upper left corners of the images. These illustrate that as a function of spectral type, and these are the coolest M dwarfs and the L type dwarfs and the T dwarfs, what are the condensates that we expect to form in their atmospheres. In the hottest one on the right hand side, the most refractory species will form out and will condense, form grains, and will form clouds. In the cooler objects, L dwarfs, run roughly around 1500 Kelvin temperatures, we will see the very prominent silicates condensing out and forming essentially dust clouds. Below them at somewhat higher temperatures, iron metal liquid will form droplets and clouds. The more refractory species will be, in this case, even further down below the visible photosphere. And if we go to the T-dwarfs, which are cooler objects, less than typically 1,000 Kelvin, we'll see that the silicate clouds are deeper in the photosphere. In fact, for many T-dwarfs, these silicates will be so deep in the below the photosphere that we cannot directly observe them. However, less refractory species will condense out. So the general prediction is coming from condensation sequence and condensation models, and we believe that this must be right. In the next slide, I show you some of the difficulties. So this shows you different ways we can imagine clouds to form. Everybody agrees that these condensate species will form at a certain temperature and pressure, the conditions are suitable, but what happens after is the big question. What sort of clouds we have and how the clouds behave and how they respond to changes, say, in the key parameters of the atmosphere is something that we don't understand, and that is actually the major challenge currently in understanding ultracool atmospheres. So here I'm just showing you a few ideas of how you could create clouds and hazes in the atmosphere. There are many other models that have been proposed. So you could create models in which there are models, and we have examples in Earth, of course, where air from an updraft will reach supersaturation, will form smaller grains. These grains will condense and then collide and further grow, and eventually until the grains are large enough that they decouple from the air, and then they can rain out. So that's a simple model that we see is working to many clouds in Earth. There are many other different clouds. Hazes on the right-hand side have also been invoked and very likely to exist on exoplanets and brown dwarfs. In this is a situation where UV photochemistry, where charged particles may form tiny particulates higher up in the atmosphere. These grains could be so small that they remain well coupled to the gas and can have residence lifetimes up there months or years. So they will not efficiently rain out. Okay, so we have different models, but these models have slightly different predictions in some cases, and in certain other situations that I will show you, they will have very different predictions. Our goal is to observationally constrain which are the correct models and help their further development in this project. In the next slide, you will see one of the most direct evidence for clouds. You see here a color magnitude diagram. On the y-axis, the absolute brightness in the near infrared is shown. On the x-axis is the color of the object. What you see here is a sequence, L dwarfs on the top in blue, and then T dwarfs in red pinkish color, and then in green there is an extension of the L dwarf sequence. Many of the directly imaged planets are falling onto that extension. If you go to the next slide, which is basically the same slide, but I drew some arrows there, or general understanding here, and that's what models predict, is that the sequence can be understood in a way that if you go down in this diagram, the temperature is getting lower and lower, so that's the key parameter. And vertically to that is the cloud thickness that we may be able to observe. So L dwarfs have, because of the condensation, initially thicker and thicker clouds as you go down, and then at some point they are cool enough that the cloud layer, the silicate cloud layer, begins to disappear or maybe break up close to the LT transition, and that's when the clouds appear to become thinner and thinner, or maybe they are becoming thinner and thinner, and the objects are becoming bluer until they will be dominated by scattering by gas. So we have, this is the general framework, the details, the spread, why the directly imaged exoplanets are lying on an extension of the L dwarfs. These are all very exciting questions that we have ideas, but no firm evidence at the moment. The fact that the directly imaged exoplanets are actually not following this sequence was a big surprise, and initially people, well, it sparked a lot of discussion on what is happening. Okay, the next slide shows two brown dwarfs. What I wanted to highlight here is that the traditional approach to testing models and understanding what the impact of cloud structure is on these objects is to observe dozens or maybe hundreds of brown dwarfs and then compare them. And this basically general classification method was helpful in establishing the relations I mentioned before, but it has its limitations. The limitations are set by the following simple fact. If you compare any two brown dwarfs, there are not only the cloud structures that are different, but also the temperature, surface, gravity, composition, age, vertical mixing, and perhaps other parameters that we don't consider currently may be different. It is very difficult, and in a sense, with the current samples, not possible to truly isolate the effect of cloud structure from all the other parameters. Okay? If you go to the next slide, that illustrates the idea behind the projects I'm going to show you. Instead of comparing different brown dwarfs and trying to isolate cloud structures there, our goal is to compare cloud structures in the same object. Okay? If you compare cloud structures in the same object, in the next slide, you will see that many of the parameters are by necessity the same, so you don't have to worry about differences there, and it becomes much easier to isolate cloud structure. To do this, of course, we have to spatially resolve, in some ways, the object. We need spatially resolved observation. In the next slide, I'm showing you the facilities that I will show results here from the Hubble Space Telescope and the Spitzer Space Telescope. The idea here is that we build on the sensitivity of these instruments and different wavelengths to take time-resolved data, because all of our targets are rotating. The time-resolved observations can be translated to spatial constraints on the heterogeneity of the object, basically surface brightness maps, if you like. So my group is carrying out programs on the Hubble Space Telescope. We have 6 programs underway, 5 observational and 1 theory program to exploit this idea. And we are also leading programs on the Spitzer Space Telescope, including a Psycho-1 program called Extrasolar Storms. This is, I believe, the second largest program on Spitzer. We have over 1,000 hours on Spitzer and a coordinated HST component. And I'm also participating in other programs that are exploiting this idea. So I will just want to show you a couple of highlights. We have many more results, but I didn't want to overload the talk here. I want to show you a few highlights from our recent observations and illustrate the potential for time-resolved observations of exoplanets with next-generation telescopes and argue that this is an observing mode that we should consider from the beginning on, and we'll show you how powerful this can be. So in the next slide, you see the first question we set out to investigate, the physical cloud structure at the cloudy, cloud-free transition. So I mentioned that when we observe cooler and cooler objects moving from the L dwarf sequence to the through the LT transition to the T dwarfs, the main difference is thought to be that L dwarfs have silicate clouds visible in the upper atmosphere, the photosphere that we can observe, while T dwarfs will have these clouds either fragmented, thinner, broken up, or below the visible photosphere. So our models do reasonably well for very thick clouds or no clouds at all, because then you don't really, it doesn't matter too much what is the cloud structure, but they really fail in between the two where the cloud structure becomes important. So our first observations focused on the region where the models fail, and that's true for essentially every model in the literature. And it's not so much a critique on the models, it was basically that the data required to test and develop a new generation of models was not available, and I think that our observations will help with that limitation. So in the next slide, you will see a typical data set that we have, and what you see in the lower window is a spectrum, a near-infrared spectrum taken with HST's Wide Field Camera 3 near-infrared GRISM. It's a low-resolution spectrum of a brown dwarf. Although it's low resolution, the value of this spectrum is its amazing signal to noise. So we can get a signal to noise of several hundred up to 800 or so in the continuum for our targets. And the truly amazing thing is that we can get this data in less than 1 minute for many of our targets, which allows us to repeat the observations and obtain basically time-resolved data. Now, on this spectrum, you basically everything you see is actually signal. There is the noise is basically on very tiny levels that are not showing up on this figure. So the high accuracy is something that we build on. Because this is a PDF presentation, you won't be able to enjoy the nice movie we have here. But so I'll just describe it for you. We have taken of this object, which takes about 8 hours to rotate. And it has a temperature around 1,000 Kelvin, so it's much cooler than most of the hot Jupiters studied today. We have taken about 660 spectral readouts during its rotation. On the top panel, you can see the normalized flux density that we measure in J-band equivalent, so around 1.1 micron. You can see that this object, this is just one band, extracted from the spectral cube we have, but it changes its brightness by 27%. This is our most worrying object, but we have many other ones that worry. We have incredibly rich data sets, spectral cubes, with one dimension around the wavelengths, the other dimension is in time, through which we can observe how this object is rotating and changing. And it is changing because its photosphere is heterogeneous. So we don't see a constant cloud coverage, but instead we see variations. So I'm sorry I cannot show you the spectrum, but the movie is actually a pretty cool one. In the next slide, you just see an illustration.
Say Daniel. Yep. Daniel, this is Harley. This is great stuff. Could you tell us, just to calibrate folks, what page number you are on now?
Okay.
Page number you are now.
Okay, in the PDF, this is page 15.
Sounds good, great. Okay,
and I just switched there, yes. So here, basically, you see the spectrum, and you see key absorbers. There are more absorbers, but I just highlight water and methane that contribute to the absorption to guide the eye. The two peaks are basically probing the continuum, and otherwise we see various absorbers. So in the next slide, let's go to 17. I show the results here for two brown dwarfs. On the top panel, you see the one that I showed you before, and the spectrum, so I'm now on page 17. You see the red and the blue spectrum. The red and blue colored spectra, they are the spectra for the brightest and faintest state of this object. On the right-hand side, you see the light curves for on the top for one object, on the bottom for a second object. These are both LT transition objects. There's a lot of stuff in this figure, but what is important is that you can see that in both cases, the spectra for different brightness states. We have hundreds of spectra between these two states. I just highlighted the maximum and the minimum. And you can see the on the left-hand side panels, the lower parts labeled ratio. That's the ratio of the maximum and minimum spectra. And if you can, you can think about it basically as the amplitude of the variation as a function of wavelength. What you see is that in the J and H bands, the amplitude is roughly similar. It has either no slope or just a slight slope, and there's a significant reduction in the water band. Okay. If you go to the next slide, slide 18 in the PDF file, you will see this is, again, a still image from a movie that won't work in PDF, but what we did here is we used the light curves that we derived from the observations and use the model. I don't go into the details, but it's basically finding the simplest surface brightness map that can explain the light curves with the assumption that the features that we see are elliptical, which is from rotating fluids, this is what you would expect. This model shows if it would be spinning, you would be able to see three large spots. We found that in both cases, to explain the light curve, the structure in the light curve, we need at least three large spots. We couldn't explain it with one or two spots, and more than three is not required by the data, although it may, of course, be present. This is not a unique model, but this is the simplest model that fits the data, which is what we are aiming to find. A very important step we could take here is to ask the question how many different types of cloud structures we have to consider. You could imagine many different types of clouds being present from different condensates, different grain sizes, maybe multi-component grains, etc. So what we could do here is to do a PCA analysis, principal component analysis, which is basically asking the question, what is the smallest number of independent components that are required whose linear combination can reproduce the observed spectral changes. And what we have found is, in fact, in both cases, and since then now in an additional three similar objects, we found that we only need one principal component sitting on top of a mean atmospheric spectrum. So that means that even though there are multiple spots and structures in these objects, the structures all introduce the same spectrum, which is a very important result, and it also means that our job is somewhat easier than if we had to deal with five, six different types of spectral contributions. So these observations, by the way, are the first of their kind, the first spectrally resolved maps of ultra-cool atmospheres. We were very excited about these results, and we went a bit further, of course. I will not show you all the details, but in the next slide, slide 19, you will see the color magnitude diagram that I showed you before, the L dwarf sequence, the T dwarf sequence, the LT transition between, and overplotted in blue and red on the left-hand side figure, you see the actual motion of the objects of these two LT transition objects I described on this diagram. The expectation and the common wisdom was, but I think in the entire community, that at the LT transition, we will see how clouds break up through holes, basically larger and larger holes, and eventually transition into the teeth wars where no clouds are visible. So this was a model that was proposed and was very popular. The direct prediction of this model would be that in the changes that we see, the variations that we see, would be moving between the L to the T dwarf sequence. In other words, they would be moving parallel with the x-axis, or roughly parallel with the x-axis of this diagram. As you see, that's not the case. The motion basically comes with a large amplitude, large brightness variation, but relatively little color change. So this was a first big surprise from our project. We carried out state-of-the-art radiative transfer models with chemistry and other components I will not describe here. We could exclude essentially every model combination. The only model combination that was consistent with our data and actually quite fully is what is shown in the green dashed line, slightly offset from the object. And this is, if we describe the atmospheres as a combination of a warm thin cloud and a cooler thick cloud. Okay, you can see on the right-hand side, lower right-hand side magnified region of the diagram that shows how the different models compared to the data and what would be their prediction. The green one is the only one that moves in the right direction. So basically, if you go to the next slide, that's just a conceptual image on slide 20, where you see on the left-hand side, that was the conventional wisdom that we should be seeing silicate clouds with large holes. Every time we see through a hole, we see in the deeper interior where temperatures are higher and there's more gas scattering from gas too. So that would mean large color variations. On the right-hand side, you see instead the picture that we found, and what we proposed is that there are small color variations, and this is explained by cloud thickness variations. When we observe a thin cloud, we see that it's warmer because we see somewhat deeper in the photosphere. When it's thicker, we are limited to higher up in the atmosphere where temperatures are lower. So in the next slide is just a summary of what I mentioned. So this study, which we published in 2013, demonstrated the spectral mapping of an ultra-cool atmosphere is possible with Hubble. We show that warm thin and cooler thick cloud combinations are the only ones that explain the LT transition. We require only a single type of thick cloud for this. That's the result from the PC analysis. And we have the spectral signature of what these clouds are introducing, allowing further studies. Okay. So in the next slide, 22, the next question I want to show you is how do clouds in L dwarfs, so the ones where we believe the clouds are thicker, differ from those in early T dwarfs or LT transition that I described. So in page 23 and 24, I'm comparing the in blue the spectra that I showed you before. So the it's labeled here T. It's really an LT transition object, very early T. This is where the amplitude is the same in J and H, or very similar, but there's a significant reduction at 1.4 micron, that's the water band. So from the fact that the J and H amplitudes are the same, we concluded that there cannot be great variations in the depth we are observing in terms of clouds and cloud holes, but instead we argued for thin and thick clouds. We next observed L dwarfs. This is what you see in the red figures, the red plots. These are brighter objects where we expected thicker clouds to be present. The spectrum, again, has some slope, but not much. And notably, the absorption, the reduced amplitude in the water band is missing. It's basically in and out of the water band is essentially the same amplitude. So this was very interesting and surprising. I will show you what we proposed as an explanation. In the next slide, 25, and I'm showing the cloud. If you go to page 26, this cloud introduces variations, modulations in the light, and that modulated light has to travel through a gas column. In the next slide, basically, I highlight that photons may come in a continuum, with the wavelengths falling into the continuum, or in the water absorption. Depending what their wavelengths is, they will see different optical depths. In page 28, we just put a toy model here together to illustrate that. Depending on the wavelengths at which the photons are emitted, they will see different extinction, basically different optical depth, and that will reduce the observable modulations at different levels. So what I showed you there, and now I'm on page 29, is a toy model. We have done did a radiative transfer model to verify this. Our interpretation is basically that the deeper your clouds are, where you are introducing the modulations, the taller the gas column that your photons have to escape through, and the taller your gas column is, the larger optical depth difference exists between photons, between wavelengths probing the water absorption and the continuum. So you will see basically a greater effect. The deeper your column is, the larger effect you will see in the opacity between the continuum and the water. And that basically explains that if our clouds in the LT transition sit deeper, then we have a deeper water column that the photons have to escape through, introducing a larger reduction. Whereas if we have clouds high up or very high hazes, the water column is much shallower and there will be much smaller or no optical depth difference introduced. So in the let's go to slide 31. In this study, we show the first spectral maps of L dwarfs. We show that there is no reduced amplitude in the water band, and we argued for high-level hazes in L dwarfs and deeper clouds in LT dwarfs. That's, so we show that by observing a different wavelength, we can probe vertical, basically vertical location of clouds. In the next slide, in the next study I want to show you is we are using this technique further. We ask the question, what is the vertical structure of the cloud layers? And that's a question we haven't fully answered yet. It's a rich question, but I want to show you some exciting results. In the next slide, page 33, you will see an artist illustration accompanying one of the press releases from our group, which shows that if you use different wavelengths, you can probe clouds in different layers. And the artist showed here two layers. In the next slide, what you see are observations. So now I'm on slide 34 from Hubble and Spitzer. We have turned two space telescopes at the same time to the same target. And if you click to the next, stay on this page 34. So the blue figures are Hubble light curves, and the red one is from Spitzer. Or taken at the same time of the same object, what you notice here is that these are out of phase. So, which is rather strange. So by probing different different depth, we see different phases. If you go to the next slide, that's very interesting. We plotted the phase shift that we observed and the model pressure on the X and Y axis. And surprisingly, what we found is that there's a monotonic dependence. So in this case, the deeper we looked, the more offset the same surface brightness distribution was. So we published this study in 2012, and that demonstrated how using broad wavelength range, we can probe many different layers. So we can currently probe six layers simultaneously, scan them basically as the object rotates. So before I go to the next slide, I wanted to see if there is any burning quick question that I should answer that relates to the, you know, understanding the concepts I used.
Yeah, folks, here's a chance to ask Daniel questions. Anybody have any questions? And feel free to, if Daniel doesn't mind, if folks have questions as he moves along, feel free to jump in lest the folks forget what the question is. One quick thing, Daniel, looking at the time, playing a good moderator, got about 22 minutes until noon.
Okay.
Quite a few slides left to go. So you know, as we tell all of our speakers, we own this line 24/7, so that if you run late, so long as you are willing and your audience is willing, we can run after the hour. We don't want to run way long after the hour, but we can run after the hour. Again, anybody have any questions for Daniel?
Yes, this is Avi on the phone.
Hi.
Daniel, I think you can probably comment on this later, but the interesting relationship between the flat Eldorf spectrum and the hot Jupiter or hot Neptune spectra that we've looked at. I don't know if you guys have thought about that.
Yes.
Yeah,
so I didn't have time to go into that, but we, using the condensation models, we were actually finding that it was very difficult through condensation to introduce clouds so high up in the atmosphere to fully suppress the water feature.
Okay.
So we actually were, what we could do with the current models was to introduce a haze layer. That's what we proposed, and it is actually a very interesting aspect that if haze exists in these brown dwarfs, which don't have a host star, then it would suggest that these are not photochemically produced hazes. They may or may not be the same hazes that we see on some of the transiting exoplanets, for example. Definitely in the solar system, there is evidence for non-photochemical haze production, so I think it's actually an interesting aspect to consider when we select targets, which may, you know, may not, we assume would not have hazes, whether or not that has to do with the photochemical production or maybe other mechanisms.
Great.
But yeah, I think that's a good question, and I can tell you more after the talk, probably.
Sure.
Okay, so let me continue because time is short a bit. And okay, so the next slide, 36 and then 37, this shows, demonstrates yet another interesting aspect that can come out from time-resolved observations, and that is actually constraining dynamics of these atmospheres. What you see here are, on the left-hand side, observations of one particular brown dwarf. On the top part, this is ground-based data taken over a course of about 4 years and various nights when it was possible to observe the object with various quality, but nevertheless, it's clear that there are some changes in the light curve. Ground-based data is quite limited, but it was a good motivation to follow up these objects from space. What you see in the lower panel in colors, that's from the 2013 paper I described, and you may think that the light curve here is rather noisy, but the surprising aspect here is actually from, we know for sure that this noise, what you see here, is not coming from our telescope or measurement, but it comes from the object itself. So in the course of the 10 hours we observed this object, this is a phase-folded light curve, it has undergone significant changes that they show up in a disk-integrated light curve. So we know that this object is very dynamic. On the right-hand side, you see another object, Lumon 16, ground-based observations that show also significant light curve changes basically in a couple of, from night to night, pretty much. Next slide, you see Jupiter and Saturn. The purpose of this slide is to point out that actually giant planets in our solar system are often much more dynamic than we necessarily realize, and which motivates the question whether or not the changes we see in brown dwarfs are similar or how they compare to giant storms that we see sometimes developing in Saturn or other changes we see Jupiter is undergoing. So the next slide is a nice picture, but I will skip it now, and let's go to page 40. That's the title of our program, Extrasolar Storms. The key question there is, what is the physical and chemical process or processes that drive the light curve evolution in brown dwarfs? The data I showed you is pretty much the ground-based data that exists today, and we argue that we need to go back and study these objects with obtaining higher quality homogeneous data over longer time to really understand what the physics is. And this figure just shows you that we visit each object 8 times with Spitzer, obtain observations in the blue and red, alternating. I will not go into the observing strategy, but rather show you the next slide, 42. This is, shows 3 visits, and you will see first empty, but it will fill in. You will see 3 visits of one of the objects. On the y-axis, normalized brightness, and on the x-axis is time in hours. If you go to the next slide, you see in blue the channel 1 and then channel 2 and channel 1 data filling in, and you can see how significantly the light curve changed basically over the course of 20 hours. If you go to the next slide, page 44, it shows you visit 5, and you see that when we return to this object, the light curve has become quite different. It had a double peak and continue to evolve. And I really love the visit 6 that you see on page 45. Here the object basically lost for a brief period the variability, the amplitude dropped, and then something really dramatic happened, and you see in a couple of hours variations as large as 10% were introduced. So we believe that these must be some really significant surface features that appear in the photosphere. We have these and a lot more data from HST2, where we are putting together currently models to interpret the dynamics and the cloud evolution that we see here. In the next slide, I just want to show you very briefly how we models that we developed to interpret these light curves. In page 47, I mentioned a code ALOS that was developed by Teodoro Karalidi, who's working in my group. It basically is an MCMC mapping code. Page 48 illustrates an image from Jupiter. This again is part of a time resolved series, 20 hours of Jupiter observations obtained with HST, that in the next slide you see in slide 49 that we can derive an ultra precise light curve from Jupiter in scattered light in R and U bands, and then we can use this light curve, feed it into our model to derive a surface map for the key features. On page 50, you see on the upper right hand that we, our model predicted that there is one dominant feature that causes most of the light curve variations. And page 51, you see that that feature actually is at the location and approximately the size of the great red spot. There was a smaller feature, an OLBA there, which was not resolved by our code, of course, but nevertheless the location size, and actually the contrast too was matched by the model. If you consider that our description is the contrast with respect to the average brightness, and you see there is a significant brightness difference across Jupiter's space. So we have a model that we have verified on solar system planets that help us to translate the maps robustly, the light curves robustly to maps. So I will skip here to page 55. I just mentioned here this is a light curve that you see, so you should be now on page 55. This is a light curve that we have obtained in a situation where we have a companion to a bright star. So everything I showed you before were brown dwarfs that were isolated. This is the first result I show you, which is in a higher contrast case. It's a moderate contrast case as far as extreme AO imaging goes today, but nevertheless we can access with these companions to stars and also extend what we have done to planetary mass companions. And building on that, in the next slide I show you the title of our recently approved large program, large treasury program, Cloud Atlas, where we are carrying out a large comparative study of cloud properties on objects with different temperatures and different surface gravities. Excuse me. Okay, now I want to, in the remaining few minutes, I want to discuss a bit the future and what these observations, the possibilities these observations open, and what we can do with this idea further. So in the next slide, I just want to point out that this is a simulation paper we published 2 years ago with Veselin Kostov, and here we demonstrated that with the next generation extreme AO systems, which are by now the state of the art currently, they have become reality, Sphere, GPI, LBT, and MEG-AO, we can actually obtain maps of directly imaged exoplanets, just like HR8799. It's within the possibilities. Not the same quality as the HST spectra cubes I showed you, but can give us maps. The next slide, I show you a figure from a Sphere study I submitted in which we apply this technique, but I will just move on to page 59 to the next generation telescope. So, of course, ATLAS and HDST from the side of the exoplanets are in large part, I believe, driven by the idea to characterize and detect Earth-like planets in the habitable zone. That really is the focus. And I was looking through the HDST report, which is an excellent study, of course, and it does focus on imaging and spectroscopy. And I wanted to point out that I think there is actually a great potential in just obtaining time-resolved data in both MOND imaging and spectroscopy, because I think it can really greatly enrich the science we can do in many ways without really necessitating any significant changes in the instrumentation. So the key goals that are currently focused on are detecting planets or obtaining orbital parameters, obtaining spectra, biosignature detection, and characterized planetary systems. And many of these observations will require multi-hour studies and often multi-epoch, for example, if we want to characterize the orbital parameters. So just by simply not integrating everything in time, we can actually get time-resolved observations, and this can greatly enhance the studies in various ways. I just want to list a couple of ideas that I think are very interesting. So when we set to characterize exo-Earths, for example, and if we imagine observing these targets maybe for 10, 20 hours to get a high signal-to-noise spectrum that allows us to look for biosignatures, we can use the continuum or integrated light to actually look for time-resolved variations. So there is a lot we can learn, and some of it may actually be crucial for understanding these objects. So the time-resolved observations can directly determine the rotation periods of these objects, which if you combine with the age, you can actually model and back out what is the magnetic field strength that you may expect in these objects. And that magnetic field and is a very important has a very important role in protecting the atmosphere from solar wind, for example, and atmospheric loss. And photodissociation of water molecules is one of the dissociation from charged particles of water molecules is one of the possible ways you could create false positive biosignatures. So I think understanding magnetic field rotation is an important component. Rotation periods will also tell you a lot about the atmospheric dynamics. In atmospheric dynamics, the rotation rate and wind speed are the two key parameters that determine your circulation. The amplitudes of the variations that we may observe on an exo-Earth can constrain the spin axis somewhat indirectly, but with sufficient data, it can provide a very good constraint on it. The time-resolved observation can also break degeneracies between surface types. And if you imagine just observing Earth, if you take an average spectrum where you mix up different cloud surface and ocean types, whereas you have time-resolved observations where you can separate these components, you will be able to get a much better handle on the covering fraction. What are just the components? The PC analysis I showed you would work also for exo-Earths. Ultimately, we can get 2D maps for exo-Earths, and there will be a talk by Nick Coven discussing this, so I didn't want to include it in here, but that's a very exciting aspect too. So the rotation rates themselves will also give us important information and will allow us to compare the targets we study to objects in the solar system. For rocky planets, we have a great range in rotation rates from 176 days of Mercury all the way down to Earth and Mars, shorter rotations. Or for gas giants, we see much shorter rotations occasionally with Jupiter about 10 hours. So the rotation rate is an important parameter, and the, breaking the surface, the degenerates in the surface features, I think will be very important for understanding exo-Earths. But even further, if we go to the next slide, I wanted to point out that at this, when we are observing the most challenging targets, the exo-Earths in our field of view, there will be hopefully plenty of other planets that we will be observing also simultaneously. And we will be able to carry out studies for on them too, and I believe a lot of good science will come from those planets too. So here are just a couple of ideas. We can, of course, look for rotation periods as a function of age and mass. Perhaps we can use rotation periods of giant planets as a chronometer to determine the age of individual systems. We can look for ice clouds in cooler objects, determine their structure, covering fraction. We can look for infrared hotspots, just like present in Jupiter and Saturn, haze distribution and evolution. And overall, we can look at atmospheric evolution, atmospheric dynamics like the one I showed you on brown dwarfs. So let me go to slide 63, which is the last slide. This is the summary slide. So I showed you that clouds pose currently a major challenge in understanding water-cooled atmospheres. There are multiple studies that I showed you here. I will not go through all the results, but we made very significant progress in understanding cloud structure variations with spectral type. We have evidence for rapidly evolving atmospheres and vigorous dynamics. I showed you how time-resolved observations at multiple wavelengths carried out simultaneously can scan multiple layers and provide us basically a 2 or even 3D map of these atmospheres. And we can validate these studies on light curves obtained from the solar system. And based on this, I would argue that time domain observations are actually going to give a very, very valuable and very important new dimension to observing exoplanets in the future with ATLAS or HDST or similar concepts. Thank you.
That was very good. Thank you, Daniel. In fact, as I think you and I were discussing via email some weeks ago, I think you hit quite a very nice tone here of a tutorial-type presentation. This is lovely stuff, so thank you. Do folks have questions? As I said, we like to end at the top of the hour, but we do own this line 24/7, so if folks have questions, now's the time to ask. Any questions?
This is Avi again. Daniel, I was wondering about the comparison between ground-based systems with XAO or just AO. I mean, I assume the actual performance for future systems like this is somewhat uncertain versus a space-based platform, similar to what you've been doing with HST or possibly ALAS in the future. What is the benefit of space versus even high XAO systems on the ground?
Yeah, so that's a very good and very important question. And, of course, it will depend slightly on how the future systems, both on ground and space, evolve. But to the first order, I think that from going with a really large telescope to space can, on one hand, allow you to really study cool planets in reflected light, which is probably not where the ground-based AO systems will necessarily go. Second, what I show basically is time-resolved observations. What you need for them, the good thing is that you don't need an extra instrument or you don't need an extra mode, but what you need is sensitivity. You need to collect your photons quickly because the signal itself is changing. So if you look for something, you know, Earth analogs or, you know, within a factor of 2, say, in rotation rate, it means that you cannot have integrations longer than 20 minutes in which you need to collect signal to noise enough to detect variations. So I think that ground-based systems, in terms of speaking about very small planets, Earth is probably beyond reach, but even for super-Earths, I think the integration times required are so long that it would probably not be feasible to carry out these observations, at least on a larger sample. In some cases, maybe yes, for the hotter objects. The other question is, of course, stability. So space-based platforms can provide relatively easily a much more stable photometric baseline than what is achievable from ground. And so I think these are probably the two directions that these assets should be compared on.
Great, thanks.
Daniel, this is Massimo.
Hi, Massimo.
Hi. I have a question about log G. You know, these are the objects that contract for the eternity once they form. Is there any effect? I mean, and log G therefore increases steadily with time, maybe slowly, but there is any difference between an object which is 300 million years and 8 billion years of age?
Yes.
How can you be sure about the fact that log G knows a parameter that plays an important role?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So surface gravity is thought to influence clouds, just cloud structure, in different ways. One of them is just basically the way the scale height will be sensitive to what is your surface gravity, because it's set by the settling of the dust grains. The pressure temperature structure will also change with the surface gravity. So you would expect from just first principles that surface gravity will influence the cloud scale height and the cloud, basically essentially all the processes through which clouds can form and evolve. However, how it really happens is depends on your models for the clouds. We currently don't have a good understanding. The best evidence that exists yet is that directly emitted planets, which have, and some of the planetary mass brown dwarfs, which have low surface gravity, they happen to be in the continuation of the L-dwarf sequence rather than following the LT transition. And that was argued. There were different models, but some of them argued that it has to do with the low surface gravity is resulting much higher cloud scale heights. To verify this, you would need a systematic study that compares objects with high surface gravity and low surface gravity using different indicators and probes of clouds at different pressures, which is possible with HST. And I'm happy to say that that's actually the focus of our recently approved Cloud Atlas program. So in that program, we will compare about 10 to 14 objects with different surface gravities and different spectral types, and we hopefully will be able to verify or disprove models of clouds and surface gravity.
Thank you.
Good. Other questions?
Yes, this is Joel Green. I just have a question about, well, it's a slightly different kind of object, but looking at the near IR spectrum of the brown dwarfs, I'm thinking, is there a similar application to, do you think this could be used to look at the inner edges of disk photospheres in certain, in young objects? And is there, does that kind of resolution gain you as much in those circumstances as it does on brown dwarfs versus, say, ground-based AO?
Yeah, so the question is whether resolved observations and basically the spatial scales you can probe through time-resolved observations, whether that's something that could be used for other topics, and definitely there have been very exciting results on time-resolved observations of protoplanetary disks. In a separate study, I also explored time-resolved observations of debris disks, but I won't go into details there. But yes, definitely there is, yes, that can be probed, and also in extragalactic. Of course, in the extragalactic community, there are also, of course, ways you can probe the environment of AGNs, for example, through time-resolved observations at multiple wavelengths. So, yeah.
I'm thinking in particular the fact that the disk would be very low G and might actually provide an interesting...
Oh, I see, in terms of the surface gravity.
Yeah.
Yes, I think there are many commonalities, so I think that would be an interesting aspect to explore.
Okay, good. Again, other questions?
Hi, Daniel. This is Veselin. Great talk.
Hi,
can you give us some flavor of what you think about polarimetry variability studies? Is there any merit in this?
Yeah. So that's a very good question. And yes, so polarimetry can add another dimension to this, of course. I think probably Nick Kovan will speak a little bit more about that. Polarization can be used for different planets to learn different things. And it really depends also on the wavelengths and the processes, but in general it can help you to constrain surface properties, reflectance spectrum from exors, ocean glint. It can also help you with constraining grain sizes, importance of scattering, for example, in the various features in gas giants or ice giants. So I think that's very important. However, the polarization will, I think that makes the observations much more challenging. So that's something that at that point, right, because you are basically just considering a fraction of the photons that you collected, and then you have to worry about the calibration, accuracy, et cetera. So I think that's a mode that has also potential to even further enrich what we can learn, but it is also something that would probably be important to consider when the instruments or telescopes are designed.
Thanks.
Okay, once again, other questions? Okay, great. Daniel, thank you so much. And
thank you very much for the invitation.
Yeah, and please, Daniel, of course, join us for future. You're on our emailing list. Join us for future every other Wednesday seminars.
Yeah, thank you. Great, thank you.
Talk to you all next time, guys.